Welcome to Talking Up Music Education, a podcast from the NAMM Foundation. Talking Up Music Education podcast shares news and stories about music education from teachers, students, parents, school, and community leaders who care about music education and are working to create more opportunities for music learning. And now, here's your host, Mary Lurson.
Hi, everybody. This is Mary Lurson with the NAMM Foundation. And welcome to this episode of NAMM Foundation's Talking Up Music Education podcast. Have to admit, I'm a little bit on edge today because I am flipping the script and handing the reins of hosting the podcast over to one of my best friends, John Malesic. So, John, am I going to be all right here, John?
I think you're going to be all right.
We're handing it to you.
I am so honored to be here today. And you know, of course, you've been having this podcast for a while, but we want to be able to really get down to really know Mary and get down to some really great details. So I'm really honored to be here and have this opportunity to talk with you. And I hope we can give your listeners something about you that they might have never known before.
But first, John, tell us a little bit about you.
Oh, well, I run NoteFlight for Hal Leonard Corporation, and I have a long background in music education and technology.
Trumpet player, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I was going to humbly say that I'm actually a first trumpet player, Mary.
We're not going to start that, John.
I spent a lot of time back in the first trumpet seat looking up and looking at the flutes in the front of the ensemble and wondering if they're ever going to stop playing sharp. But, you know, we'll...
I know. I had a whole list prepared of first chair flute player, trumpet player, trumpet section jokes, but I'm going to refuse to use them.
It's Sunday at NAMM. We've had a great successful show. We're going to rise above and we're not going to do any petty musical instrument. Right. It's just going to be all of that. Well, you know, one of the things that for me that I'll share briefly is that I came in this industry straight from being a music teacher. I did not know the industry. I did not know what a NAMM was at the time. And one of the first people I met that first show was, of course, Mary. And I saw you and I talked with the fly and I went there and the whole world just changed for me and everything clicked. And so from there, I knew that the industry is all about music education, building each other up. And that's been, for me personally, one of the best growth paths in my life professionally and personally has been what I've experienced with you and the foundation and how we support music education. So to be here today and talk more about that with you is really amazing.
Well, great, John. So give it to me, John. What you got for me today?
I've got a whole bunch of questions.
I always ask the questions.
So. All right, here's the questions. Well, let's just dig in right away. You know, we all know your background. We know how much work you've done. We listen to this podcast. Before I get into my questions, I'd love to know, you've interviewed lots of people. Is there something that you're dying to tell your listeners that you've wanted to say just from you? Is there anything that was going to give you an open platform? Before we get going on everything else, is there something you want people to know about you and your work that you feel like you've never had the opportunity to really, really tell them?
Well, that's a wonderful opportunity. I think that as I look back at the channels of the work that I do, one of them being hosting Talking at Music Education, which we're easing into over close to 100 episodes. I don't know what episodes this is going to be. And all the people I've talked to in that platform and the people that I work with in Washington and our NAMM members that step forward, there's really one essential formula for all, pretty much the advocacy work, the artistic work, the creative work, the business work that's getting done here at the NAMM show and all year long. It's called passion and action. You know, it's when there's a fire and a drive. And with that passion and action is also the reality. You have to take in a lot of information to move that passion in action forward. And I also encounter that so much with the nonprofit service organizations that we fund through the NAMM Foundation, also through our nonprofit institute here. I had a fascinating conversation here about someone that was pitching me on his project. And he was pitching me with his belief in the threats that were around us that his project could save. And I finally had to say, I said, first of all, the information that you're stating is, I don't really think is accurate. So let's go back and look at the information that you're stating. I mean, this gentleman had so much passion that he was really trying to find a pathway to action. But he'll get there if he continues to, you know, take input and take advice and feasibility and whatnot. And I look out at the NAMM show, we're actually sitting here in a Gator booth. We're so grateful to Gator Cases that we could do a podcast here, looking at it, you know, at so much activity. And I think one of the reasons folks come to the NAMM show, or they go to any conference, really, is to gather information to put their passion into action. So they get out of the way of themselves, you know, so they come and they gather. And I interact with, you know, hundreds of people, thousands probably over the year. And I just see people sort of in a spectrum of where they are on that path. But what I respect and value most, and I think this comes with experience, maturity, and all this, I respect and value so the passion. I just respect it. And wherever the action is, I respect that. And then you also respect the fact that people are on this pathway to learning and information gathering and changing as they take their passion to action.
I love that passion to action piece. I mean, we are a passion industry, whether you're a former or whether an advocate, we are a lot of heart. And you're right, but there has to be action with that as well.
And I mean, you think, right, we're looking across at a wall of symbols here, right? And that has a history, that has a phenomenal history from handmade to it's built, and there's someone banging on one over there, you know, actually looks like a young woman is banging pretty hard. I should say playing, performing a cymbal, right? And, you know, testing out sound, you can see there's a pretty intelligent little performer there playing on the edge and playing around, taking in information, right? So I think as we interact with one another and support one another, we realize that we're helping someone in that area to keep their passion and transform into action. And when I get confused about something, I have to kind of put that in that continuum, right?
Right.
I have to say, well, they're coming at me with a lot of passion here.
All right. So I'm going to come at you with some passion now.
Okay.
So, all right. So, you know, one of the things that I've adored about and learned so much from you is, you know, these Mary-isms that stick with me, and passion and action, of course, is now going to be one. But the Mary Lurzen drinking game is relentlessly positive and coalition, right? And you won't last 2 minutes and that game will all be on the floor like a Sunday morning at a NAMM show. But but you know, that is your style from the moment I met you 8 years ago. And like, I've seen that in you. And let's be real. When you started 19 years ago, when you came into this role, then before that, has that always been Mary? Have you always been this incredibly optimistic, passion? You said something yesterday or the other day at the support music meeting, radical kindness was a new Maryism I wrote down, you know, kindness, passion, positive, really, you know, is this always been you? Is this a style that you had to learn over the time and the advocacy work? Where did this beautiful soul come from?
Oh, you're so
That's
sweet.
That's what I want to know.
You're so sweet. Well, honestly, it's a practice like everything else in life, right? It's a practice.
Practicing the flute.
And practicing the trumpet. I didn't know you ever practiced, but you probably did.
I don't have to. I just picked it up and played a double C, and it was fine. It's easy.
This is what happens when John and I get together. Just get over it, people. This is what happens. No, honestly, it's a practice. And yeah, you know, I came to NAMM 19 years ago, and I didn't know what NAMM was. I had never been to a NAMM show. The reality for me is that my first job ever as an elementary band director, I was working directly with a NAMM member who was my provider and supplier of rental instruments. And when I walked into my very first NAMM board meeting in Nashville, the chair, or I think the vice chair of NAMM, was that NAMM member,
wow.
Paul Hyde. And I remember walking into the meeting and I thought, oh my goodness, I know exactly where I am. So, I mean, passion, action, right? I mean, I had so much to figure out. And I was hired as a staff of one with a public, you know, I wanted the title, and we got the title worked out, Director of Public Affairs and Government Relations. There was no NAMM Foundation. So I think like all of us who have a vision for ourselves, I wanted to be that person that was sort of someone you wanted to see and say hello to. I don't think I always was, you know, I think I was caught in a lot of, I mean, I was a performing artist for a long time, right? One reason I got a little sour on the classical music game was because some of the people that I was bumping into at 8 o'clock at night in the pit, right, or in the orchestra, you know, as I was advancing through my 30s, were kind of not that happy about where they were, you know? And it was kind of a part of my decision that I didn't want music to mean that to me, right? I didn't want music to mean something that was a labor or something that was just something you had to go and do to you know. So, yeah, there was a lot of introspection and reflection along the way. But, you know, you set a vision for yourself, right?
Right.
We get to do that. We get to set a vision for ourselves. And then we have to say, well, to get that done, I'm going to have some very deliberate kind of practices for myself. And one was, you know, I'm also a person that really values a lot of alone time. It's kind of interesting. People think, oh, you must be out at meetings all the time. Yeah, I'm really kind of not, you know. Yeah. I mean, I come up for air and I, you know, and I know what I want to do, but I also have a lot of quiet time, and I'm a real long walker, and I love winter walking. I mean, don't hit me over the head with anything, but I love walking in the winter. And I bike ride and I kayak on Long Island Sound, and I endurance swim. I'll swim for 90 minutes and not very well or fast, but I do it. So, you know, I think that...
And that's your alone time.
Yeah, I think that it's that balance. So I guess I made a decision in this part. I mean, I came to this career wedge of my career with the opportunity to build something for NAMM with a new understanding of myself, and I think it was just like, I'm going to build it with the practice of, I said it the other night too, I said, we come from a place of abundance.
Right.
We come from a place of opportunity. We come from a place of relentlessly positive. We come from a place of, you know, why don't we start there? And it's music, doggone it, you know?
It's music, yes.
Yeah, we're going to put our stake in the ground and start there and then move it forward. So.
Well, I'm hearing so much positivity. It sounds like this has always been you from even 19 years ago coming, even when you were teaching elementary band, you have had passion, you have had positivity and drive. And I can hear that just through your stories. And I can also add a similar moment as a performing classical musician in a quintet and playing in the orchestras and playing the pits, same gig, same people. And I were surrounded by people that were not as happy about it, that were in their 60s and just had to do it for work. And I was like, I want to be passionate about it. So I can tell that I have a very similar experience there, and I can relate to this idea about being passionate. I can tell that's what drives you. So now, how do you fill your tank? So you're incredibly passionate, you're incredibly optimistic, and you've faced some huge challenges and big hurdles, and I'm sure there's a lot more in there that we can unpack in another podcast.
Right.
So at some point, I could imagine that Mary takes a walk alone and says, I need to fill my bucket because you were such a giver to others. What do you do? Where do you go for inspiration? What do you read? We talked about exercise. How do you keep your tank full to give so much to these organizations?
You know, the other piece of me is that I am really a political junkie.
Uh-huh.
Just get over it. And I'm a policy junkie. And I am just passionate about what's happening in the world. I can read the major newspapers every morning for hours. I generally can't. So I'm just interested, right? I'm interested in stuff.
You know what you are? Right. You're a lifelong learner.
Yeah, I guess.
Learning, keeping up
with
information.
I'm just interested in stuff. And
learning drives you. Now we're getting into it, folks.
Yeah, I'm just interested in stuff.
Involvement.
And I, you know, when all the stuff that was happening in Brexit, you know, with Theresa May, I was following that so closely, not because I was on one side or the other side of Brexit, though I kind of, you know, you could push me in a corner and I'd tell you where I am. But I just was so interested by the dynamics that was happening among the people.
Yes.
And I still am. You know, how can you be so, by something that's going to change a country for generations based on some interactions of just personalities and, you know. So I guess I'm a studier, right? I'm kind of a studier and curious. So the choice for me is when I get really overwhelmed. And there's a lot of that too, because lists get too long and phone calls go unanswered and emails go unanswered. And also at this time in my work, I really want to have meaningful, substantial connections. And there's, you know, a lot of opportunities to move things forward. Then it's the choice between, you know, I go for a bike ride every day in the nice weather. So that's just part of it. But, you know, a walk, or sit with a stack of newspapers.
Right. Well, here's, you know, what's amazing. I mean, you are a change maker and you know this, right? And that's what you're but
if that works for you, you can call me that.
Well, I've seen you enact a lot of change and you build coalition. But it's interesting to hear this and learn this about you, because it sounds like you're a change maker that's fueled by change.
Yeah.
You're looking at Brexit, you're looking at policy, you're looking at how policies affect society and how people and how it affects our world and what changes happen and how that affects the dynamics and tensions between others. And to hear that that's what fills you up and knowing that you come back and it gives you more drive to come in and do that in your own work.
Well, ultimately, John, I'm a teacher. I mean, there's just no other way around it. So when I look at, you know, I'm looking for models. I'm looking for the modeling. I'm looking for the structure inside. And that's how when, you know, you came into the advocacy work and you, like our meeting on Friday was all about modeling something.
Right.
Right. How do we model? How we model how we feel? We have to model that. What we do, we model that. And then someone goes, I'll go, oh, I see that in myself. I could take those actions in my, that I see myself doing that model. So therefore you build this national network that we have now that people are engaged in advocacy because we built the scaffold for them and we built the pathway for them to identify themselves in that scaffold.
Yes.
And that's the only way it's working.
So let's talk about
not me
modeling.
Telling anybody.
Oh, exactly.
But they coming to the table and going, I'm going to have a piece of that.
You don't have to be in charge to be a leader. You know, you figure that out really quickly. I mean, so I'm interested, you know, you talk in this industry, almost all of us are start as musicians and we are passionate because we play music for passion. And then, and you look in the industry, we have lots of different roles, whether it's teachers, professors, musicians, retail, I mean, all the different jobs, but there's one core value that we kind of all start as musicians. And that's something I'm interested to know from your perspective. And of course, you've been a first flute player and a strong musician. What is it that we learn as musicians that can later be transferred into all the various roles that we end up filling in the industry or in life later? And then I'm going to, spoiler alert, I'm going to swing that back to say, how does that cycle back to the value of music education to keep building musicians because we have these skills that make us successful, which makes us more, drive it back to get more students to learn music so they can have these skills and we're successful and we build this incredible growth.
You know, I don't know if I should start with the brain science or if I should start with more practical things, but maybe I'll start with both. But the brain science unequivocally tells us that music making at any age really changes the brain.
Right.
Unequivocally.
Right.
What it tells us is that it strengthens the neural bundling. It actually grows neural bundling, and it actually strengthens that neural bundling that happens through the auditory experience. I mean, we know this cold, right? What we don't know, and I think what you're on the pathway to hear talking about, is what does that mean?
So as musicians, we can say our neurons are bundled differently.
You got all this gray matter capacity that you've achieved by intense practicing, right? But what we are learning, continue to learn, is what does that mean? So we have this. So I think what happens to musicians, and this has just not been proven, this is kind of my wild guess. I think we go, when we train in our lives, we have this gray matter capacity that just gives us kind of a nimbleness. And we have a kind of an intellectual nimbleness that says, yeah, I can problem solve my way through, put it on the table.
Right.
Because we also have sort of a creative capacity that we've also gained through practice and that we can say, yeah, let's figure it out. I'll figure out how to, you know, you turn you and me loose somewhere on this floor.
Let's do it.
You have to make this company successful in 24 months. We would figure it out. I mean, we'd have to go to school. I'd have to get a lot of help, but I'd go ask for it, right?
That's lifelong learning.
All right, but that's the nimbleness that I think comes in from that reality of all of that stuff that we were the benefit of. Now, that goes back to music education. If we, in there, again, I go to the research, you know, in early childhood, if children have this capacity to learn and identify beats and keep a steady beat, unequivocally, we know that they will read better. Why? We kind of don't know exactly why. Well, we kind of do. But we know that the auditory pathway and the bundling and the firing and the, you know, you help the brain organize to do something as complex as decode words.
We have lots of evidence that clearly demonstrates that right. reading and music skills are better. And we may not necessarily know why or necessarily how from a scientific standpoint.
But we have evidence that it does.
We have tons of evidence that. But isn't there a lot of things in the world? I mean, there's a lot of healthcare, and we know that certain diseases exist, and we know that what the traits are, but we still don't even know how you get there. I mean, there's lots of areas in the world.
Most of our understanding comes from correlation, not from causation.
Exactly.
Right? So this is when I like to say, you know, John, it's just a no-brainer. Right? And I said that once to a neuroscientist, and they laughed off of their chair when I said it's a no-brainer. But it is kind of a no-brainer that, Nina Kraus says that we are what we do. We are what we do. And, you know, with the music learning and the music training, and all this is cumulative and additive to, and it's positive for the brain, and it's positive for the stimulation that we're the, yeah, that's why we do what we do.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I know a lot of people listening, we all try our hardest to be advocates. We really do. And I saw the coalition meeting Friday. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger. In fact, it got too big this time. It turns people away. But, and that's not too big. You know, so I think it's really amazing. I've seen more people and a lot of us struggle with having the right amount of time to be advocates. We don't know the exact research by Kraus. We don't know exactly what to say. What would you say to someone that just wants to advocate? It feels like they don't have the bandwidth at the time or the know-how to do so.
Thank a school board member. Thank a school administrator. Thank a music teacher. Step one is appreciation for where you are. If you are somewhere, right? I mean, if you are somewhere where there is some level of children making music and children coming together to play music and parents, family and school board members surrounding and being there too. And then from there, you have the part, maybe not that at the same time you're thanking, because you don't want to be thank you, but, right? It's like, you then start to say, could we ever have a conversation about how we could advance this opportunity for more children or strengthen our program for all children?
So be thankful and open a dialogue and build a relationship.
And then right now you have become an advocate. Now, when that person says, yeah, I'm dying to talk to you about it. Oh, now you're going to have to do something. Right.
Well, is that passion to action?
It is. But some people kind of go, well, I can't fit it into my life. Too busy. I really want to, thanking and helping is the best pathway to advocacy.
But even in that example, if you open a conversation and you just go be thankful and someone's like, yes, I want to talk to you about music ed, and you say, oh, I don't have time, whatever. But now you've created a thirst for knowledge from someone, like the fact maybe there's someone else that has time, or maybe you can introduce them to the right people,
or you say, well, I'm really wrapped up with kids and stuff for the next 6 months, but let's get together right during budget season and let's talk about it.
Why just give them your cell phone number and say to text you?
Right. Oh, thanks a lot, John.
On the weekend while you're on a long walk or something, to Mary will take care of it.
Right. I think part of our success is that we've built an army of lieutenants, people that are doing that in a lot of places.
One thing I've learned in my short time, I'm not that old, though my knees and gray hairs tend to actually have prescription glasses now. I didn't have them on now, but I can see you just fine. But I can't see this paper,
John,
unless it's out here.
Yeah.
But one thing I have learned is I felt like this industry, and you're built on mentors and mistakes, is one thing I've been thinking about a lot. Of course, you being a mentor, I found very often. And obviously, you know, Larry Morton and Hal Leonard and others that have just been, you know, wonderful. And my last job at PreSonus, Rick Nockby and Jim Boyd. And it's people that just you learn from. They become your mentors. And obviously, we make lots of mistakes, and it's how you react. So I want to know, for Mary, who are your biggest mentors and what were your biggest mistakes?
Oh, that's a great question. Mentors. You know, I always had a problem with the whole concept of mentors because
they don't have to be men.
Well, no, because we were all supposed to have one, and I could never kind of, I did, because I worked remotely, right?
Uh-huh.
And, but yeah, I think before I came to NAM, I was in a, you know, pretty intense and professional environment at the Texaco Foundation.
Gotcha.
And the president of that foundation had come from the Philip Morris world we're going back decades now. When corporate philanthropy was really, gravitas was really important. And we were kind of, at Texaco, we were sort of the tail end of some of that, right? So Ann Dowling, who was still with us and now works with the Gustavo Dudamel Foundation, she, I'd have to say, was a mentor on a lot of levels, because she helped me understand that really good work is complex, and you're working with a foundation board and working with opinions and holding your own through all of that. So in other words, it's like going into a complexity and this intensity, so many different dynamics and so many people seeking resources. And, you know, I mean, it was just like bumper cars from every place. And, you know, just kind of how you guide through to get something that you want to get done. And for us at that time was to support and expand music education with our grant making program. We did a lot, you know, and we created a lot of visibility for the company, but not enough, obviously, because it got sold. So, but then to go through that. So, boy, I really learned a lot. It was like a fast track. Yeah. So, but in that time, to have people that just sort of valued what I brought to the table, I think it's the most important thing about mentoring. So you think you're going to learn X, Y, and Z and fill in the blanks of things, but a mentor, most of all, values who you are and values right. what you bring to the table and gives you that validity why you're jostling around with all these challenges. You know? And that she did that for me. You know, she and we're still friends, and I love seeing her. And she's one of the most elegant people I know. And Texaco was a very technology, engineering dominated oil company. Women were just coming up through the ranks. So it was also a wonderful lesson to how we need to carry ourselves and how we carry ourselves into these intense environments and through these intense environments. So, it's important. So mistakes. These are the things that, you know, I don't know about you, but I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I'll just think of something that happened 30 years ago and it's still right there.
Yes.
And it just hurts, you know? I mean, we are all full of them, right? And the primary mistakes was overestimating or underestimating or not estimating at all that there was a relationship out there that I didn't intend. It was just that I was moving too quickly. I wasn't organized.
Tell me about underestimating a relationship.
Just not knowing that they were really seeking a connection. You know, and it goes way back to I had a mom of a student once. Yeah. And a really talented student. And I was also at the time where, you know, it was all about the ensemble. It was about the choir. About the group. And there was something about the education energy of the time. I think it was in the early 80s that, you know, it wasn't about holding up the talented, right? It was like making sure everybody had this equity of experience. So I didn't have any soloists at the concerts.
It was all first trumpet players, no first.
No, sorry, John. No, it was all ensemble and everybody, you know, the trumpet section would play, but I just didn't do it that way. I didn't hold up the most talented. Right. It was just like, I think it was a different approach. So this mom came to me, you know, remember it so well. And, you know, just saying how seriously this impacted her kid who wanted to sing, I think it was Little Mermaid. Uh-huh. Right. And she had a gorgeous voice.
I want to be where the people are.
Yeah.
Part of this world.
I know. And then I said, who am I to stand on this sort of principle that this sweet, lovely, gifted kid should sing at the spring concert? So it's like, I was like stuck on a principle here. And I just had it for no real reason. Right?
Interesting.
So I had to like just, and I gave in very quickly because I realized that I didn't want to, first of all, I was holding down an example for other kids.
Right?
And I had to reorientate my whole self. I was not, it was a mistake.
You know what's interesting? Not to bring it to me, but I get asked that question too. I think about some of my mistakes and being someone in music technology. I tell this story in almost every session I do about designing music tech curriculum. If I could go back in time and just like smack my 27-year-old self over the head, I would go back to the time I tried to teach students to create something in GarageBand. And I said, now everyone, I've made you a folder. Take loop A and drag it in. Okay, now take this part and drag it in. We're going to call this the B section. I was conducting an ensemble of creativity. And the kids were sitting there. And the one student was not paying attention to me, not doing it my way. And I looked over and I saw this incredible multi-track, you know, composition he'd made in GarageBand. And I was like, what are you doing? That's not what I was trying to do. Don't work ahead. And I told a kid to stop creating music. He's like, John, are you kidding me?
Right.
And is that the idea? Because I think I you know, I had a piece of paper that said I could teach music, so I knew everything. You know, I had a degree in crippling student debt, so I was ready to go. You know, like, and you go in there, and then you learn very quickly that it's, you got to let students' voice shine through. You got to give them opportunities.
Yeah, I was really kind of stuck in. Well, I want you to do it my way. And this parents can be tough, and this parent was tough. Right. And
of course.
Said some tough things, too. So you have to take it in without defensiveness. And, you know, then you realize you really are at there. You are there to serve.
Did this
reorient it myself?
This moment, did that impact your drive to build a coalition? The first thing you told me, I've heard you say it 1,000 times. It's back to the Mary Lures and Drinking Game, which if anyone does create this, I get 10% of royalties on it because I came out, just so you know.
I get 90% of that.
Okay, perfect. But build a coalition. Did this mentor and this sort of mistake impact your drive?
Probably not for a good while. Because I didn't understand the political process or systems till much later.
Of course.
But it was in that era, that 5 or 6 years, it was really the crossover that I went and became into it, the department chairperson.
Right.
And then I went into politics, right? I mean, when you start having to, you see in it, then it was when I was seeing inequities and I asked myself, how do I fix these inequities? And the inequities were across a very simple, well-funded district. But there were still, you know, programs on one side of town that were different than the other side of town. And then how do we, you know, go to the leadership of the district and say, how do we create? And guess what? At the end of the day, they hired more teachers.
Right.
So it was a great solution. And we went to a parent rental program. So all the instrument quality went up as opposed to one school having great instruments, the other school having bad instruments. But that was, boy, talk about a bath of fire.
A bath of fire.
But I had a really cool head. Every decision was fraught with flame out.
And cool then, head and a bath of fire.
Yeah. Luckily, I think I could talk my way to the table and then allow the process for reasonable heads to prevail.
Well, right. It's clear that you are such a relationship-focused person. I mean, you talk about, when I first asked about mistakes, and you talked about undervaluing, overvaluing, missing opportunities for relationships. That's the first place you went. And so it's clear that your focus is building the right relationships, getting the right coalition.
So then why am I in my house for weeks at a time and I don't see anybody? No, I do. I mean,
it's your gas station. Right, you got to fill your tank, go out there, drive as far as you can, come back, fill your tank. I think makes perfect sense.
I think that's just kind of the reality of it.
Clear that that's your focus and clear that that's your style. Right. And that's where I think the positivity, because anyone that invests in relationships know that you're not going to build a lot of relationships if you're not positive.
Right.
So I want to take that. I want to think a little bit about, because I wanted to, on this episode, get into sort of the larger landscape of advocacy for the folks listening and say, because I think people listen, we all fit in a different place. So I want to think about the relationships of all the different parts of this ecosystem. And this was something for me that, coming in as a music teacher, I knew performing music and I knew teaching music. And of course, I was a 27-year-old trumpet player, so I knew literally everything. I was, you know.
Absolutely.
again, but, you know, and then all of a sudden there's government impact, there's policy impact, there's the industry impact. And then even in the industry, the manufacturer, the retailers, the people that touch the schools. And then there's local government, and then there's associations involved. And there's all these pieces. And then higher ed, I think, has a piece. And so I think it forms this ecosystem. And I use that word intentionally because it's an ecosystem where every piece is dependent on each other's for life and we all grow together. So I'd really want to ask you and to kind of lay out, how do you think this ecosystem, all these various pieces, work together? And more specifically, is there any one or two that you find that are like the lifeblood of the entire ecosystem, that if we lost it, the whole thing crumbles, or ones we could take from and build strength from?
Yeah, ecosystem is a great word. I also, when I'm trying to find where we are in the ecosystem, I use the word mosaic, because I spend some time in the New York City subways. And believe it or not, there are beautiful...
Playing flute?
No, darling, I don't do that. I don't need to do that anymore. I'd give you a dollar. I don't need to do that anymore.
Do you have change for a five?
Right. My case isn't big enough.
Right. Oh, exactly.
I need a bigger case.
Oh, my gosh.
But, but in the subways of New York, believe it or not, there are remarkable old tile mosaics.
Yeah.
So, wherever we go in the world, there's ancient mosaics or little tiny pieces that all kind of have color graduation, and then they come together and you step back.
Right, step 50 back.
50 feet, 60 feet, and then you see, oh my God, it's Michelangelo, descending from, touching God's finger, but you don't see it when you're close. You have to step back and see this mosaic. So I think... In the coalition building, what I had to accept is we were never going to have control. That's like job one.
We as the NAMM Foundation.
Got you. Called the National Coalition for Music Education, which is what it was called 20 years ago, right? That it was never going to be about structural control. That it was about motivating and stimulating and exciting and convening this mosaic of energies that all are moving on their own.
So you don't consider yourself a piece of the mosaic, more of someone that's putting the right pieces in, us to step back.
Watching the mosaic, feeding the mosaic, fueling the mosaic, convening the mosaic. I mean, you think of the nonprofits that are in that mosaic that have in their mind that they are going to change music education. I think it's kind of a noble goal, but boy, that's a tough one.
Passion.
They're going to contribute.
Right.
They are definitely contributing. It's a very graduated mosaic. But at the end of the day, we're going to step back and we want to say 50 million kids in the U.S. all playing and making music in some capacity. That's the picture that we're working on. So I have to kind of, as I interact with, again, so many people that are pieces of that mosaic.
Right.
So I don't think that, there are some really key leadership organizations, NAFME, National Association for Music Education, sure. I think has done a remarkable job. People are also leading pieces of it really effectively, but not all of it effectively. And that's the fun of coalition building.
Right.
I mean, that's the essence of coalition. You have this, you want the picture. So, but to say that our success is going to be defined that everybody sees us as the leader, it's not 21st century anymore. It's not 21st century. 21st century is collaborative leadership. It's building the coalition that we went over the mountain together, right?
Just like our government does every day.
Yeah, well, they'll catch up eventually, right?
Right. Well, it's interesting, because we do advocacy. There's policy. We do a lot in D.C., we do a lot of lobbying for, of course, Title IV Part A and all of that, when there's the big successes we had in ESSA. But there's so much more than that, too, as part of. So, are there pieces of the mosaic that are missing right now? If you could fill in a piece of the mosaic right now, where would you fill in the most?
I can only speak for NAMM. I mean, I think we need to build a closer alliance as we've had with the music therapy people in the health and wellness field. People kind of strike out and say, well, we'll just take care of what we do, as opposed to we'll take care of what we do and we'll contribute to the mosaic, And I think that, all the work that I do is just a metaphor of this great NAMM show. Look at this great NAMM show. All these diverse competing brands are all here together.
Right.
That's what we want to build in our advocacy, in our community, that the NAMM show could be a place where we could all gather to have those conversations, to be those organizations together, to say, my piece is here, your piece is here, I value your piece, how can we work together? Maybe we can't now because we're just too busy working in our other things, I think the field, quote unquote, has done really well at understanding this collaborative leadership model, and that we all have our place. We're all going to move forward in our lanes that we choose to be in. But occasionally, we step back together and see, are the pieces fitting together? And are we creating an access opportunity mosaic? Because at the end of the day, that's kind of what it's about, access, opportunity, participation. And does this mosaic that I will never map. I just don't have the hours of the day to map what's going out there. I kind of have it, feel it organically a little bit, what the mosaic of all of that is happening. But I have a sense that it's moving forward, right?
Access, the opportunity, participation.
I think it's moving forward.
Now, those three elements, you know, you think of a music teacher in a classroom, and then you have maybe a retailer that's serving as a local strong advocate for that community. And then you have an association or a nonprofit that's doing nonprofit work. And then you have government policy, these pieces. Do each of these pieces provide access, opportunity, or participation, or does one fill in one of those for the other, and do they grow together?
It could be. I mean, I think, you know, one of the biggest challenges with working with a NAM local retailer was to get them to reach out into their community in a different way.
Right.
That's access, opportunity, right?
And participation.
Yeah. So sometimes this, again, this mosaic of energies forced down onto the grassroots level says, well, I didn't know I could do that. And immediately you've shifted some action, right?
Got you. So, well, I think what you mentioned before when you had asked, you know, you said we started with what you do to be an advocate or what you tell you, and you talked about just think a school board member, have a conversation.
You know your community.
That's a easy way to participate that opens up an opportunity and creates access.
Which is also very 21st century now. We're all living local.
Oh, I want to be in the group text. Yeah, it's a social world where
we're all living local again. We want to know our neighbors. People are moving into neighborhoods where people have parties at the end on a Friday night, you know. It's cool.
Yeah, well, I think we all want to be connected in some way. And that's the beauty of the NAM show. One of the funniest things about the NAM show is I always, like, you know, get in the lift, go to dinner, get in the cab, come back. I always love asking the driver, I said, is it always this crazy? Because this is obviously a large convention center, hosts lots of different industries across the year. But even from the waiter at the Hilton bar, to the Lyft driver, to all these people that are, they all say, no, NAM, this is the one, music one. This isn't the biggest one we have in Anaheim, but this is the one that we love it every year.
We're also huggers.
I know. When you said bat the fire, I was going to say, like, that's what we all want to take after we leave the NAM show. Right. We just want to, like,
I know,
a lot of touching.
Yeah, but we had a new lobbyist with us here for the first time. And he goes, you know, I'm not a hugger. I've been in the international lobbying field. He goes, he says, I'm going to learn to hug. I'm into it. I know. He said, boy, you people are just huggers.
Oh my gosh. That's so funny.
That's great.
No, it is
true. It's a real privilege.
Well, taking all of this in, and I had this question here about if I gave you a magic lamp and you had a genie pop out, and, you know, and you could have three wishes for this industry. What would those be?
Well,
first wish.
First,
you can't wish for more wishes.
Every NAM member around the world was 100% engaged in Make Music Day.
Okay, June 21st, right?
June 21st. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a gift from the universe. NAM did not invent this. This was created by the French in the 1980s. It's now a national holiday there. And there are some really intelligent, forward-leaning, community-minded countries around the world that are embracing this from coast to coast. So it's whatever you do. You could just say, put a sign on your door, says, come in and play a harmonica for free. Whatever it is. I mean, this is the fuel that we can give to the world that is so positive.
I love it.
Day. So, and a lot of our NAM members, I mean, we've got terrific NAM members in leadership roles that are participating. So, you know, we know sometimes June 21st falls on a Tuesday, not such a great day, you know, and sometimes it's graduation season and all of that.
But
you know, it's a day, it's the longest day of the year. The sun gave us this day, and I think we need to take advantage of it. It is a gift from the universe.
Right.
And we, to make music in that we're building on a tradition that has already had legs and there's models, this is like golden, right? So the second wish, that every child in the world entered life and about age 3 or 4, they walked into an organized classroom of whatever, and in their classroom, there was a music learning center. and there was some energy in the environment to equip those children to know, to start at that age, to have a pathway for what's inside of them out.
Glad you mentioned in the world, and one thing we didn't get into is so the international presence in NAM, and I meant to touch on the new initiative at the border and what you announced yesterday. I don't know if this audience has heard about that particular initiative yet. Do you want to talk just briefly the international?
Yeah, we've been involved with the International Society for Music Education, and their executive committee was with us this week, including their president, their new president from Africa, who's one of the most beautiful women I've ever met. And to have her here was just thrilling. The International Music Council was here, and their musical rights work, which is, they're just remarkable and so inspiring, and we participate with them. The European Music Council was here. You know, again, getting NAM members connected to this effort.
Right.
You know, just being connected, go to their conferences, send someone that even would do, you know, some product demonstration for classrooms at those conferences, not to miss those angles. So that would, the second one is that every child would have the opportunity in their early learning and through early adolescence. After that, you know, I think there's a self-selection that happens.
Of course.
But when we make it, you know, almost quasi-compulsory, that it's like, yes, you're going to express your physical being through music, you're going to express your cultural language through music, you're going to express your anger, your emotional capacities, your happiness, your joy, your ability to play with another person on a drum through music. And it's just not, you know, it's kind of universal, but it's not universal
right.
enough that it's not structured in, though even, you know, there's some wonderful people in the world that make sure within the refugee camps that they have drum circles.
Well,
so, I mean, there are really well-meaning outreach things that becomes like an education minister wouldn't set up past anything unless
sure.
it had it in it.
We talked
right.
really about brain research and, of yeah. course, building those neuron bundles. And, of course, that feeds the need for early childhood music as I would go as far as say definitely compulsory. I'll take the quasi out of it. You
yeah.
know what I mean? But,
yeah, I mean, I'm not going to enforce my view onto public policy. I mean, well, you
know. Okay, wish three.
Wish three.
Only one more left. It's got to be a good one.
Oh, boy.
And you cannot wish someone to love yourself. Make you love you. It cannot be done. What are the rules in Aladdin? There were three.
No.
You cannot bring people back from the dead. Can't do that either.
Yeah. Wish three. That's a tough one, John. Did you send me these questions before?
No. This is 100% Mary, y'all. This is not.
Oh, boy. My third wish, if Aladdin was here and said.
That's right.
I wish that at least two or three times a week. Let's start there.
Okay.
That I could have this kind of conversation with someone. And I think that the depth of our human connections is, I think that's why people go to ukulele circles, by the way. Why they join a ukulele club, why they join a choral society and sing Handel once a year, or they're part of a community band. Yeah, they're making a lot of great music. But at the end of the day, they could say to someone, someone says, so how is that kid and how is that kid doing that you were taking care of? Or, you know, that they can have a feeling that someone is kind of watching over them a little bit, or
right.
they were kind of watching over. I think this fabric of the way we live day to day is being strengthened with music, but ultimately that's what we need. And that's, for me, been the blessing to be a part of NAM is, you know, I think I put out a lot for NAM. You know, I'm cranking out a lot
right,
for NAM.
Right.
The people at NAM, have, you know, I'm in a team that we really care about each other.
Right.
And we really watch for each other. We're really concerned about each other. People at NAM, board members at NAM have expressed their concern for me when they know I've had some tough. I mean, that just.
Of course. So it's those deep connections.
Oh,
that's for you. It's the
just,
opportunity
yeah.
to have these. Well, so you're basically saying I've already made one of your wishes come true.
You have.
Stop.
And, you know, our work together is not done, you know.
Never.
We've got stuff we got to do, so.
Mary, I can't tell you how much I love. I mean, I think of any other way. We should make this an annual tradition. And just at the end of the NAM show, just have give you a chance to just speak freely about it. I think it's so wonderful.
I would say all the same things.
I could ask you a million questions. I could take you all. So, all right.
Well, you've been very kind because I never thought anyone would you know, want to get that deep inside my head. But
this is the beginning.
But I'm an open book. So
you are. I was hoping to get into some things. Well, all right. So we're gonna wrap up. If the folks that are listening right now, you're gonna say something, and they're gonna do exactly what you say in this very moment as they're listening, whether it's next week or tomorrow or whenever this comes out. Everyone that's listening is going to take the action right now in their lives as soon as they hear your words that you tell them to do. What are you going to tell them to do?
Count your blessings.
Oh, beautiful.
Be grateful, right? Say something out loud that you're grateful for. Say one thing out loud that you're grateful for. You know, and the other thing is hug somebody today, you know? I have a wonderful little dog that I just love. That's the other good thing that I've done for myself. And I always, when I'm not with her, I always write to my dog sitter, who's just a fantastic family. And I said, kiss the little girl on the head for me. And they always do, you know? So let somebody know that you're there and you care. And that's all part of counting your blessings.
Fantastic. Well, I appreciate this very much. And for everyone that's currently listening, counting your blessings and embracing someone next to you, and the person next to you is wondering why you're embracing them so hard right now. Right. Just you'll explain later.
Right. Explain later. That's how you and I started our day. So I loved it. We did it.
Absolutely.
All right. So I need to sign off because this is my podcast.
Okay. I will hand the keys. I will flip it back. This is the official flip back. It'll make us flip sound. Right. Ready?
Flip the script.
Script has been flipped.
Right. This is my podcast. Well, it's the NAMM Foundation's podcast. I get to host it. So thank you all for being part of this with my best friend, John from No Flight. Hal Leonard. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
You are the best, honestly. And thank you all for being part of Talking at Music Education, a podcast of the NAMM Foundation.
Talking Up Music Education is a podcast created by the NAMM Foundation. To learn more about how you can support music education in your community or how you can be part of the work of the NAMM Foundation, visit our website, www.namfoundation.org, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/NAMM Foundation. You can also follow Mary on Twitter at Mary L. NAMM. That's Mary L-N-A-M-M.